way upon meeting new people. Shafa's interest in her is simply too obvious, but she causes no trouble, so the people of Jekati are as friendly toward her as they are toward Jija, if in a slightly more guarded fashion. It is the other Origen children who unashamedly embrace Nasun for everything she is. The oldest of them is a coaster boy named Aitz, who speaks with a strange, choppy accent that Nasun thinks of as exotic. He's 18, tall, long-faced, and if there is a perpetual shadow in his expression, it does nothing to mar his beauty in Nasun's eyes. He's the one who welcomes Nasun on the first day after it becomes clear that Jija will live.
Found Moon is our community, he says in a deep voice that makes Nasun's heart race,
leading her to the small compound that Shafa's people have built over near Jekati's weakest wall. It's up a hill. He leads her toward a pair of gates that swing open as they approach.
Numinous, head the folk, huh? And Jekati has this. Place where you can be yourself and always be safe. Shafa and the other guardians are here for us too, remember? This is ours.
Found Moon has walls of its own, shaped from the shafts of columnar rock that dominate this area. But these are uniformly sized and perfectly even in conformation. Nasun doesn't even have to assess them to realize they have been raised by Orogeny. Within the compound are a handful of small buildings, a few new, but most parts of old Jekati left abandoned as the Calm's population dwindled. Whatever those used to be, they have since been refurbished into a house for the guardians, a mess hall, a wide-tiled practice area, several ground-level store sheds, and a dormitory for the children. The other children fascinate Nasun. Two are West Coasters, small and brown and black-haired and angle-eyed. Sisters, and they look it, named Oegan and Yinigan. Nasun has never seen West Coasters before, and she stares until she realizes they are staring at her in turn. They ask to touch her hair, and she asks to touch theirs back. This makes them all realize how strange and silly a request that is, and they giggle and become instant friends without a head petted between them. Then there is Pido, another Somid ladder, who looks like he's got more than a little Antarctic in him because his hair is bright yellow and his skin is so white that it nearly glows. The others tease him about it, but Nasun tells him that sometimes she burns in the sun too, though she carefully doesn't mention that this takes the better part of a day rather than minutes, and his face alights. The other children are all from lower Somid Lats comms, and all have visible sunset in them. Dishati was in training to become a stone napper before the guardians found her, and she asks Nasun all sorts of questions about her father. Nasun warns her off, talking to Jija directly. Dishati understands at once, though she is sad about it. Wude gets sick when he eats certain kinds of grain, and is very small and frail because he doesn't get enough good food, though his orogeny is the strongest of the bunch. Lashar looks at Nasun coldly and sneers at her accent, though Nasun can't tell the difference between how she speaks and how Lashar does. The others tell her it's because Lashar's grandfather was an equatorial, and her mother is a local comm leader. Alas, Lashar is an origin, so none of that matters anymore. But her upbringing tells. Shirk is not Shirk's name, but she won't tell anyone what that really is, so they started calling her that after she tried to duck out of chores one afternoon. She doesn't anymore, but the name stuck. Peek is similarly nicknamed, because she is tremendously shy and spends most of her time hiding behind someone else. She has only one eye and a terrible scar down the side of her face, where her grandmother tried to stab her, the others whisper when Peek is not around. Her real name is Zif. Nasun makes 10, and they want to know everything about her, where she came from, what kinds of foods she likes to eat, what life was like in Terimo. Has she ever held a baby Kirkuza because they are so soft? And in whispers they ask about other things, once it becomes clear that Shafa favors her. What did she do on the day of the rifting? How did she learn such skill with orogeny? This is how Nasun discovers that it is rare for their kind to be born to orogen parents. Wude comes the closest, because his aunt realized what he was and taught him what she could in secret. But this amounted to little more than how not to ice people by accident. Some of the others only learned that lesson the hard way. And Oegin grows very quiet during this conversation. Dashadi actually didn't know she was an orogen until the rifting, which Nasun finds incomprehensible. She is the one who asks the most questions, but quietly, when the others are not around, and in a tone of shame. Another thing Nasun discovers is that she is much, much, much better than any of them. It is not simply a matter of training. Aits has had years more training than her, and yet his orogeny is as thin and frail as Wude's body. Aits is in control of it, enough to do no harm, but he can't do much good with it either, like find diamonds or make a cool spot to stand in on a hot day or slice a harpoon in half. The others stare when Nasun tries to explain the latter most, and then Shafa comes away from the wall of a nearby building. One of the guardians is always watching while they gather and train and play, to take her for a walk.
What you do not understand, Shafa says, resting a hand on her shoulder as they walk, is that an orogen's skill is not just a matter of practice, but of innate ability. So much has been done to breed the gift out of the world.
He sighs a little, sounding almost disappointed.
There are few left who are born with a high level of ability.
My father killed my brother because of it, Nasun says. Uchi had more orogeny than me. All he ever did was listen with it, though, and say weird things sometimes. He made me laugh. She keeps the words soft because they still hurt to say, and because she said them so rarely. Chicha never wanted to hear it, so she has had no one with whom she could discuss her grief until now. They're over by the southern terraces of Jekiti, successive platforms high above the floor of a lava plain valley. The terraces are still heavily planted with grains, greens, and beans. Some of the plants are beginning to look sickly from the thinning sunlight. This will probably be the last harvest before the ash clouds get too thick.
Yes. And that is a tragedy, little one. I'm sorry.
Shafa sighs.
My brethren have done their job too well, I think, in warning the populace about the dangers of untrained orogens. Not that any of those warnings were false. Just exaggerated, perhaps.
He shrugs. She feels a flash of anger that this exaggeration is why her father looks at her with such hate sometimes. But the anger is nebulous, directionless. She hates the world, not anyone in particular. That's a lot to hate. He thinks I'm evil, she finds herself saying. Shafa looks at her for a long moment. There is something confused in his gaze for a moment, a wondering sort of frown that he gets from time to time. Not quite intentionally. Nasun cesses him in a fleeting pass, and yes, those strange silvery threads are flaring within him again, lacing through his flesh and tugging on his mind from somewhere near the back of his head. She stops as soon as his expression clears, because he is fiendishly sensitive to her uses of orogeny, and he does not like her doing anything without his permission. But when he is being tugged by the bright threads, he notices less.
You aren't evil, he says firmly. You are exactly as nature made you, and that is special, Nasun. Special and powerful in ways that are atypical for even one of your kind. In the fulcrum, you would have rings by now, perhaps four, or even five. For one your age, that's amazing.
This makes Nasun happy, even though she doesn't fully understand. Wude says the fulcrum rings go up to 10. Wude has the most talkative of the three guardians, agate-eyed Nida. Nita sometimes says things that don't make sense, but the rest of the time she shares useful wisdom, so all the kids have learned to simply tune out the gibbering.
Yes, 10.
For some reason, Shafa seems displeased by this.
But this is not the fulcrum, Nossen. Here, you must train yourself, since we have no senior origins to train you. And that's good, because there are things you can do.
His face twitches, flicker of silver through him again, then quiescence.
Things you are needed to do, which... things that fulcrum training cannot do.
Nossen considers this, for the moment ignoring the silver. Things like making my orogeny go away.
She knows her father has asked this of Shafa.
That would be possible, when you reach a certain point of development. But to reach that point, it is best that you learn to use your powers with no preconceptions.
He glances at her. His expression is non-committal, but somehow she knows. He does not want her changing into a still, even if it does become possible.
You are lucky to have been born to an origin skilled enough to manage you as a child. You must have been very dangerous in your infancy and early years.
It's Nasun's turn to shrug at this. She lowers her gaze and scuffs at a weed that has worked its way up between two basalt columns.
I guess.
He glances at her, his gaze sharpening. Whatever is wrong with him, and there is something wrong with all of Found Moon's guardians, it vanishes whenever she tries to hide something from him. It is as if he can sense obfuscations.
Tell me more about your mother.
Nossen does not want to talk about her mother. She's probably dead. It seems likely, though she remembers feeling her mother's effort to shunt the rifting away from Tarima. People would have noticed that, though, wouldn't they? Mama always warned Nossen against doing orogeny during a shake, because that is how most origins get discovered. And Uche is what happens when origins get discovered.
Perhaps.
His head cocks like that of a bird.
I've seen the marks of fulcrum training in your technique. You are precise. It's unusual to see it in a grit.
He pauses, looks confused again for a moment, smiles.
A child of your age. How did she train you?
Nossen shrugs again, thrusting her hands into her pockets. He will hate her if she tells him. If not that, he will surely at least think less of her. Maybe he will give her up. Shafa moves to sit on a nearby terrace wall. He also keeps watching her, smiling politely, waiting, which makes Nossen think of a third, worse possibility. What if she refuses to tell him, and he gets angry and kicks her and her father out of Found Moon? Then she will have nothing left but Jija.
And she sneaks another look at Shafa. His brow has furrowed slightly, not in displeasure, but concern. The concern does not seem false. He is concerned about her.
No one has shown concern for her in a year.
Thus, finally, Nossen says, "We would go out to a place near the end of the valley, away from Tarimo. She would tell Daddy she was taking me out hunting for herbs."
Shafa nods.
That is something that children are normally taught in comms outside the Equatorial Node network.
A useful skill, should a season come.
She would call it girl time. Daddy used to laugh.
And you practiced orogeny there?
Nossen nodded, looking at her hands.
She would talk to me about it when Daddy wasn't home. Girl talk.
Discussions of wave mechanics and math, endless quizzes, anger when Nossen did not answer quickly or correctly.
But at the tip, the place she took me to, it was just practice. She had drawn circles on the ground. I had to push around a boulder, and my torus couldn't get any wider than the fifth ring, and then the fourth, and then the third. Sometimes she would throw the boulder at me.
Terrifying to have 3 tons of stone rumbling along the ground toward her, and to wonder, if I can't do it, will Mama stop? She had done it, so that question remains unanswered. Shafa chuckles.
Amazing. At Nasun's look of confusion, he adds, that is precisely how origin children were trained at the fulcrum. But it seems your training was substantially accelerated.
He tilts his head again, considering.
If you had only occasional practice sessions to conceal them from your father.
Nasun nods. Her left hand flexes closed and then open again as if on its own. She said there wasn't time to teach me the gentle way. And anyway, I was too strong. She had to do what would work.
I see.
Yet she can feel him watching her, waiting. He knows there's more. He prompts.
It must have been challenging, though.
Nasun nods, shrugs. I hated it. I yelled at her once, told her she was mean. I told her I hated her and she couldn't make me do it. Shafa's breathing is, when the silver light is not stuttering or flickering within him, remarkably even. She has thought before that he sounds like a sleeping person, so steady is it. She listens to him breathe, not asleep, but calming nevertheless. She got really quiet. Then she said,
Are you sure you can control yourself?
And she took my hand.
She bites her lip then.
She broke it. Shafa's breath pauses just for an instant.
Your hand?
Nasun nods. She draws a finger across her palm, where each of the long bones connecting wrist to knuckle still ache sometimes when it's cold. After he says nothing more, she can continue.
She said it didn't matter if I hated her. It didn't matter if I didn't want to be good at orogeny. Then she took my hand and said, don't ice anything. She had a round rock and she hit my hand with it.
The sound of stone striking flesh. Wet popping sounds as her mother set the bones. Her own voice screaming, her mother's voice cutting through the pounding of blood in her ears.
You're fire, Nasun. You're lightning. Dangerous unless captured in wires. But if you can control yourself through pain, I'll know you're safe.
I didn't ice anything.
After that, her mother had taken her home and told Jija that Nasun had fallen and caught herself badly. True to her word, she'd never made Nasun go to the tip with her again. Jija had remarked later on how quiet Nasun had become that year.
Just something that happens when girls start to grow up, Mama had said.
No, if Daddy was Jija, then Mama had to be Esun.
Shafa is very quiet. He knows what she is now, though. A child so willful that her own mother broke her hand to make her mind. A girl whose mother never loved her, only refined her, and whose father will only love her again if she can do the impossible and become something she is not.
That was wrong,
Shafa says. His voice is so soft she can barely hear it. She turns to look at him in surprise. He is staring at the ground and there is a strange look on his face. Not the usual wandering, confused look that he gets sometimes. This is something he actually remembers, and his expression is guilty, rueful, sad.
It's wrong to hurt someone you love, Nasun.
Nasun stares at him. Her own breath catches, and she doesn't notice until her chest aches and she is forced to suck in air.
It's wrong to hurt someone you love.
It's wrong.
It's wrong.
It has always been wrong. Then Shafa lifts a hand to her. She takes it. He pulls, and she falls willingly. And then she is in his arms, and they are very tight and strong around her the way her father's have not been since before he killed Uche. In that moment, She does not care that Shafa cannot possibly love her, when he has known her for only a few weeks. She loves him. She needs him. She will do anything for him. With her face pressed into Shafa's shoulder, Nasun senses it when the silver flicker happens again. This time, in contact with him, she also feels the slight flinch of his muscles. It is barely a fluctuation, and might be anything. A bug bite, a shiver in the cooling evening breeze. Somehow, though, she realizes that it is actually pain. Frowning against his uniform, Nasun cautiously reaches toward that strange place at the back of Shafa's head, where the silver threads come from. They are hungry, the threads, somehow. As she gets closer to them, they lick at her, seeking something. Curious, Nasun touches them and senses, what, a faint tug? Then she is tired. Shafa flinches again and pulls back, holding her at arm's length.
What are you doing?
She shrugs awkwardly. You needed it. You were hurting. Shafa turns his head from side to side, slowly, not in negation, but as if checking for something he expects to be there, which is now gone.
I am always hurting, little one. It's part of what guardians are. But,
his expression is wondering. By this, Nasun knows the pain is gone, at least for now. You're always hurting? She frowns. Is it that thing in your head? His gaze snaps back to her immediately. She has never been afraid of his ice-white eyes, even now as they turn very cold. What? She points at the back of her own skull. It is where the sesapinae are located. She knows from lectures on biomimicry in creche. There's a little thing in you, here. I don't know what it is, but I sensed it when I met you. When you touched my neck. She blinks, understanding. You took something then to make it bother you less.
Yes, I did.
He reaches around her head now and sets two of his fingers just at the top of her spine, beneath the back edge of her skull. This touch is not as relaxed as other times he has touched her. The two fingers are stiffened, held as if he's pantomiming a knife. Only he isn't pantomiming, she realizes. She remembers that day in the forest when they reached Found Moon, and the bandits attacked them. Shafa is very, very strong. Easily strong enough to push two fingers through bone and muscle like paper. He wouldn't have needed a rock to break her hand. Shafa's gaze searches hers and finds that she understands precisely what he's thinking about doing.
You aren't afraid?
She shrugs.
Tell me why you aren't.
His voice brooks no disobedience. Just... She cannot help shrugging again. She can't really figure out how to say it. I don't... I mean... If you have a good reason?
You have no inkling of my reasons, little one.
I know. She scowls, more out of frustration with herself than anything else. Then an explanation occurs to her. Daddy didn't have a reason when he killed my little brother. Or when he knocked her off the wagon, or any of the other half-dozen times he's looked at Nasun and thought about killing her so obviously that even a 10-year-old can figure it out. An ice-white blink. What happens then is fascinating to watch. Slowly, Shafa's expression thaws from the contemplation of her murder into wonder again, and a sorrow so deep that it makes a lump come to Nasun's throat.
And you have seen so much purposeless suffering that at least being killed for a reason can be borne.
He's so much better at talking. She nods emphatically. Shafa sighs. She feels his fingers waver.
But this is not a thing that can be known beyond my order. I let a child live once who saw, but I should not have. And we both suffered for my compassion. I remember that.
I don't want you to suffer, Nasun says. She puts her hands on his chest, wills the silver flickers within him to take more. They begin to drift toward her.
It always hurts.
That isn't right.
Many things ease the pain. Smiling, for example, releases specific endorphins, which...
He jerks and takes his hand from the back of her neck, grabbing her hands and pulling them away from him, just as the silver threads find her. He actually looks alarmed.
That will kill you.
You're going to kill me anyway. This seems sensible to her.
He stares. Earth of our fathers and mothers.
But with that, slowly, the killing tension begins to bleed out of his posture. After a moment, he sighs.
Never speak of what you sess in me around the others. If the other guardians learn that you know, I may not be able to protect you.
Nasun nods. I won't. Will you tell me what it is?
Someday, perhaps.
He gets to his feet. Nasun hangs on to his hand when he tries to pull away. He frowns at her, bemused. But she grins and swings his hand a little, and after a moment he shakes his head. Then they head back into the compound. And that is the first day that Nasun thinks of it as home.
Seek the origin in its crib. Watch for the center of the circle. There you will find...
obscured.
Tablet 2, The Incomplete Truth, verse 5. 10. You've got a big job ahead of you. You've called him crazy so many times, told yourself that you despised him even as you grew to love him. Why? Perhaps you understood early on that he was what you could become. More likely it is that you suspected long before you lost and found him again that he wasn't crazy. Crazy is what everyone thinks all Ragas are, after all, addled by the time they spend in stone, by their ostensible alliance with the evil Earth, by not being human enough. But crazy is also what Ragas who obey choose to call Ragas that don't. You obeyed once because you thought it would make you safe. He showed you, again and again, unrelentingly, he would not let you pretend otherwise. That if obedience did not make one safe from the guardians, or the nodes, or the lynchings, or the breeding, or the disrespect, then what was the point? The game was too rigged to bother playing. You pretended to hate him because you were a coward, but you eventually loved him. And he is part of you now, because you have since grown brave.
I fought Antimony all the way down.
Alabaster says.
It was stupid. If she'd lost her grip on me, if her concentration had faltered for an instant, I would have become part of the stone. Not even crushed, just mixed in.
He lifts a truncated arm, and you know him well enough to realize he would have waggled his fingers, if he still had fingers. He sighs, not even noticing.
We were probably into the mantle by the time Inan died.
His voice is soft. It's gotten quiet in the infirmary. You look up and around. Lerna's gone, and one of his assistants is sleeping on an unoccupied bed, snoring faintly. You speak in a soft voice, too. This is a conversation for only the two of you. You have to ask, though. Even thinking the question makes you ache.
Do you know? Yes. I sensed how he died.
He falls silent for a moment. You reverberate with his grief and your own.
Couldn't help sensing it. What they do, those guardians, is magic, too. It's just wrong. Contaminated, like everything else about their kind. When they shake a person apart, if you're attuned to that person, it feels like a niner.
And of course, you were both attuned to Inan. He was a part of you. You shiver because he's trying to make you more attuned to the earth and orogeny and the obelisks and the unifying theory of magic. But you don't ever want to experience that again. It was bad enough seeing it, knowing the horror that resulted had once been a body you held and loved. It had felt much worse than a Niner.
I couldn't stop it.
No, you couldn't.
You're sitting behind him, holding him upright with one hand. He's been gazing away from you, somewhere into the middle distance, since he began telling this story. He does not turn to look at you now over his shoulder, possibly because he can't do so without pain. But maybe that's comfort in his voice. He continues.
I don't know how she manipulated the pressure, the heat, to keep it from killing me. I don't know how I didn't go mad from knowing where I was, wanting to get back to you, realizing I was helpless, feeling like I was suffocating. When I sensed what you did to Koru, I shut down. I don't remember the rest of the journey, or I don't want to. We must have. I don't know.
He shudders, or tries to. You feel the twitch of muscles in his back.
When I came to, I was on the surface again, in a place that...
He hesitates. His silence goes on for long enough that your skin prickles. I've been there. It's difficult to describe. That isn't Alabaster's fault.
On the other side of the world, Alabaster finally says, there is a city.
The words don't make sense. The other side of the world is a great expanse of tractless blankness in your head, a map of nothing but ocean.
On an island?
Is there a landmass there?
Sort of.
He can't really smile easily anymore. You hear it in his voice, though.
There's a massive shield volcano there, though it's under the ocean. Biggest one I've ever sensed. You could fit the Antarctics into it. The city sits directly above it on the ocean. There's nothing visible around it, no land for farming, no hills to break tsunami, no harbor or moorings for boats, just buildings, trees and some other plants, of varieties I've never seen elsewhere. Gone wild, but for a forest, sculpted into the city, sort of. I don't know what to call that. Infrastructures that seem to keep the whole thing stable and functioning, but all strange. Tubes and crystals and stuff that looks alive. Couldn't tell you how a tenth of it worked. And at the center of the city there's a hole.
A hole? You're trying to imagine it. For swimming?
No, there's no water in it. The hole goes into the volcano and... beyond.
He takes a deep breath.
The city exists to contain the hole. Everything about the city is built for that purpose. Even its name, which the Stone Eaters told me, acknowledges this core point. It's a ruin, Essen. A dead civ ruin like any other, except that it's intact. The streets haven't crumbled. The buildings are empty, but some of the furniture is even usable. Made of things not natural, undecaying. You could live in them if you wanted.
He paused.
I did live in them when Antimony brought me there. There was nowhere else to go and no one else to talk to. Except the Stone Eaters. Dozens of them, Essen. Maybe hundreds. They say they didn't build the city, but it's theirs now. Has been for tens of thousands of years.
Your mind full of how much he hates being interrupted, but he pauses anyway. Maybe he's expecting commentary, or maybe he's giving you time to absorb his words. You're just staring at the back of his head. What's left of his hair is getting too long. You'll have to ask Lerna for scissors and a pick soon. There are absolutely no suitable thoughts in your head besides this.
It's something you can't help thinking about when you're confronted with it.
He sounds tired. Your lessons rarely last more than an hour, and it's been longer than that already.
You would feel guilty if you had any emotion left in you right now, other than shock.
The obelisks hint at it, but they're so...
You feel him trying to shrug. You understand?
Not something you can touch or walk through. But this city. Recorded history goes back, what, 10,000 years? 25 if you count all the seasons the university's still arguing about. But people have been around for much longer than that. Who knows when some version of our ancestors first crawled out of the ash and started jabbering at each other. 30,000 years? 40? A long time to be the pathetic creatures we are now, huddling behind our walls and putting all our wits, all our learning, toward the singular task of staying alive. That's all we make now. Better ways to do field surgery with improvised equipment. Better chemicals so we can grow more beans with little light. Once we were so much more.
He falls silent again for a long moment.
I cried for you and Inan and Koru for 3 days, there in that city of who we used to be.
You ache that he included you in his grief. You don't deserve it.
When they brought me food.
Alabaster skips past whatever he would have said so seamlessly that at first the sentence doesn't make sense.
I ate it.
Then tried to kill them. His voice turns wry.
Took me a while to give that up, actually. But they kept feeding me. I asked them again and again why they'd brought me there. Why were they keeping me alive? Antimony is the only one who would speak to me at first. I thought they were deferring to her, but then I realized they just didn't speak my language. Some of them weren't used to interacting with people at all. They stared, and sometimes I had to shoo them away. I seemed to fascinate some, disgust others. The feeling was mutual. I learned some of their language eventually. I had to. Parts of the city talked in that language. If you knew the right words, you could open doors, turn on lights, make a room warmer or colder. Not everything still worked. The city was breaking down. Just slowly. But the hole. There were markers all around it, lighting up as you got closer.
You suddenly remember a chamber at the fulcrum's heart, long narrow panels igniting in sequence as you walked toward the socket, glowing with no discernible fire or filament.
Barriers big as buildings in themselves, which sometimes glowed at night. Warnings that would write themselves in fire on the air before you. Sirens that would sound if you got too near. Antimony took me to it, though, on the first day that I was... functional. I stood on one of the barriers and looked down into a darkness so deep that it...
He has to stop. After he swallows, he resumes.
She told me already that she took me from Mayov because they couldn't risk me being killed. So there at Corpoint's heart, she told me, "This is why I saved you. This is the enemy you face. You are the only one who can."
What? You're not confused. You think you understand. You just don't want to, so you decide that you must be confused.
"That's what she said," he replies.
Now he's angry, but not at you.
Word for word. I remember it because I was thinking that was the reason Inan and Koru died and you got thrown to the rusting dogs. Because sometime in the ass end of history, some of our so-smart ancestors decided to dig a hole to the heart of the world for no rusting reason.
No.
For power, Antimony said. I didn't know how that was supposed to work, but they did it. And they made the obelisks and other tools to harness that power. Something went wrong, though. I got the sense that even Antimony didn't know exactly what. Or maybe the Stone Eaters are still arguing about it and nobody's come to a consensus. Something just went wrong. The obelisks misfired. The moon was flung away from the planet. Maybe that did it. Maybe some other things happened. But whatever the cause, the result was the shattering. It really happened, Ersun. That's what caused the seasons.
The muscles in his back flex a little against your hand. He's tense.
Do you understand? We use the obelisks. To Stills, they're just big strange rocks. That city, all those wonders, that dead sieve was run by Origins. We destroyed the world. Just like they always said we did. Ragas.
He says it so sharply and viciously that his whole body reverberates with the word. You feel how he stiffens as he says it. Vehemence hurts him. He knew it would, and said it anyway.
What they got wrong,
he continues, sounding weary now,
are the loyalties.
The stories say we're agents of Father Earth, but it's the opposite. We're his enemies. He hates us more than he hates the Stills because of what we did. That's why he made the Guardians to control us, and
you're shaking your head. Pastor, you're speaking as if the planet is real. Alive, I mean. Aware. All that stuff about Father Earth? It's just stories to explain what's wrong with the world, like those weird cults that crop up from time to time. I heard of one that asks an old man in the sky to keep them alive every time they go to sleep. People need to believe there's more to the world than there is. And the world is just shit. You understand this now after 2 dead children and the repeated destruction of your life. There's no need to imagine the planet as some malevolent force seeking vengeance. It's a rock. This is just how life is supposed to be, terrible and brief, and ending in, if you're lucky, oblivion.
He laughs. This hurts him too, but it's a laugh that makes your skin prickle, because it's the laugh of the Humanus Alia High Road. The laugh of a dead node station. Alabaster was never mad. He's just learned so much that would have driven a lesser soul to gibbering that sometimes it shows. Letting out some of that accumulated horror by occasionally sounding like a frothing maniac is how he copes. It's also how he warns you, you know now, that he's about to destroy some additional measure of your naivete. Nothing is ever as simple as you want it to be.
That's probably how they thought,
Alabaster says when his laughter goes quiet.
The ones who decided to dig a hole to the world's core. But just because you can't see or understand a thing doesn't mean it can't hurt you. You know that's true.
But more importantly, you hear the knowledge in Alabaster's voice. It makes you tense. What have you seen?
Everything.
Your skin prickles. He takes a deep breath. When he speaks again, it's a monotone.
This is a 3-sided war. More sides than that, but only 3 that you need to concern yourself with. All 3 sides want the war to end. It's just a question of how.
We're the problem, you see, people. 2 of the sides are trying to decide what should be done with us. That phrasing explains a lot. The Earth and the Stone Eaters? Always lurking, planning, wanting something unknown.
No, they're people too, Ersun. Haven't you figured that out? They need things, want things, feel things, same way we do. And they've been fighting this war much, much longer than you or I. Some of them from the very beginning.
The beginning? What?
The Shattering? Yes, some of them are that old. Antimony is one. That little one who follows you too, I think. There are others. They can't die, so... Yeah, some of them saw it all happen.
You're too floored to really react. Hoa? 7-ish years old, going on 30,000?
Hoa? One side wants us, people, dead,
Alabaster says.
That's one way to end things, I suppose. One side wants people neutralized, alive, but rendered harmless, like the Stone Eaters themselves. Earth tried to make them more like itself, dependent on itself, thinking that would make them harmless.
He sighs.
I guess it's reassuring to know the planet can cock up, too.
Your flinch is a delayed reaction, because you've still got Hoa in mind.
He used to be human, you murmur.
Yes. It's just a disguise now, a long-discarded set of clothes donned again for old time's sake. But once upon a time, he was a real flesh-and-blood boy who looked like that.
There's nothing Sunzid in him, because the Sunzid did not exist as a people in his day. They all did. It's what's wrong with them.
He's very tired now, which may be why he speaks more softly.
I can barely remember things that happened to me 50 years ago. Imagine trying to remember 5,000 years ago, 10,000, 20. Imagine forgetting your own name. That's why they never answer when we ask them who they are.
You inhale in realization.
I don't think it's what they're made of that makes Stone Eaters so different. I think it's that no one can live that long and not become something entirely alien.
He keeps saying, imagine, and you can't.
Of course you can't.
But you can think of Hoa in that moment, being fascinated by soap curling against you to sleep. His sorrow when you stopped treating him like a human being. He'd been trying so hard, doing his best, failing in the end.
You said three sides, you say,
focusing on what you can, instead of mourning what you can't. Alabaster is beginning to slouch, leaning harder against your hand. He needs to rest. Alabaster is silent for so long that you think he might have fallen asleep. Then he says,
I slipped out one night when Antimony wasn't there. I'd been there years. Time got loose after a while. No one but them to talk to, and sometimes they forget that people need to talk. Nothing in the earth to listen to except the grumbling of the volcano. The stars are all wrong on that side of the world.
He trails off for a moment, loose time, catching up with him.
I'd been looking at diagrams of the obelisks, trying to understand what their builders intended. My head hurt. I knew you were alive, and I missed you so much. I was sick with it. I had this sudden, wild, half-rusted thought. Maybe, through the hole, I could get back to you.
If only he had a hand left that you could take. Your fingers twitch against his back instead. It's not the same.
So I ran to the hole and jumped in. It's not suicide if you don't mean to die. That's what I told myself.
Another felt smile.
But it wasn't. The things around the hole are mechanisms, but not just for warning. I must have triggered something, or maybe that was how they were meant to work. I went down, but it wasn't like falling. It was controlled somehow. Fast, but steady. I should have died. Air pressure, heat, the same things Antimony took me through without the rock involved. But Antimony wasn't there, and I should have died. There are lights along the shaft at intervals. Windows, I think. People actually used to live down there. But mostly it's just the dark. Eventually, hours or days later, I slowed down. I had reached.
He stops. You feel the prickle of goosebumps rise on his skin.
The earth is alive!
His voice grows harsh, hoarse, faintly hysterical.
Some of the old stories are just stories, you're right, but not that one. I understood then what the Stone Eaters had been trying to tell me. Why I had to use the obelisks to create the rift. We've been at war with the world for so long that we've forgotten Esun. But the world hasn't. And we have to end it soon, or...
Alabaster pauses suddenly for a long and pent moment. You want to ask what will happen if a war so ancient doesn't end soon. You want to ask what happened to him down there at the core of the earth, what he saw or experienced that has so plainly shaken him.
You don't ask. You're a brave woman, but you know what you can take and what you can't. He whispers,
when I die, don't bury me.
What give me to Antimony?
As if she has heard her name, suddenly Antimony reappears, standing before you both. You glare at her, realizing that this means Alabaster has reached the end of his strength and that the conversation must end. It makes you resent his weakness and hate that he is dying. It makes you seek a scapegoat for that hatred.
No, you say, looking at her. She took you from me. She doesn't get to keep you.
He chuckles. It's so weary that your anger breaks.
It's either her or the evil earth, Aesun. Please.
He begins to list to one side. And maybe you're not as much of a monster as you think, because you give up and get up. Antimony blurs in that stone-eaterish way, slow except when they aren't. And then she is crouched beside him, using both hands now to hold and support him as he slips into sleep. You gaze at Antimony. You've thought of her as an enemy all this time, but if what Alabaster says is true...
No, you snap. You're not really saying it to her, but it works either way. I'm not ready to think of you as an ally yet.
Maybe not ever.
Even if you were,
says the voice from within the Stone Eater's chest. I'm his ally,
not yours.
People like us with wants and needs.
You want to reject this too. But oddly, it comforts you to know that she doesn't like you either.
Alabaster said he understood why you did what you did. But I don't understand why he did what he did, or what he wants now. He said this was a three-sided war. What's the third side? Which side is he on? How does the rift help? No matter how you try, you cannot imagine Antimony as having once been human. Too many things work against it. The stillness of her face, the dislocation of her voice, the fact that you hate her.
The obelisk gate amplifies energies both physical and arcane. No single point of surface venting produces these energies in sufficient quantity. The rift is a reliable, high-volume source.
Meaning? You tense. You're saying that if I use the rift as my ambient source, channel it through my torus...
No, that would simply kill you.
Well, thanks for the warn-off. You're beginning to understand, though. It's the same problem you keep having with Alabaster's lessons. Heat and pressure and motion are not the only forces in play here.
You're saying the earth churns out magic too? And if I push that magic into an obelisk...
You blink, recalling her words. Obelisk gate?
Antimony's gaze has been focused on Alabaster. Now her flat black eyes slide to finally meet yours.
The 216 individual obelisks networked together via the control cabochon.
While you stand there wondering what the rust a control cabochon is, and marveling that there are more than 200 of the damn things, she adds,
using that to channel the power of the rift should be enough.
To do what?
For the first time, you hear a note of emotion in her voice. Annoyance.
To impose equilibrium on the Earth-Moon system.
What?
Alabaster said the moon was flung away.
Into a degrading long ellipsis orbit.
When you stare blankly, she speaks your language again.
It's coming back.
Oh, Earth. Oh, rust.
Oh, no.
You want me to catch the fucking moon?
She just stares at you, and belatedly you realize you're practically shouting. You throw a guilty look at Alabaster, but he hasn't woken. Neither has the nurse on the far cot. When she sees that you're quiet, Antimony says, "That is an option." Almost as an afterthought, she adds, "Alabaster made the first of two necessary course corrections to the moon, slowing it and altering the trajectory that would have taken it past the planet again. Someone else must make the second correction, bringing it back into stable orbit and magical alignment. Should equilibrium be re-established, it's likely the seasons will end, or diminish to such infrequency as to mean the same thing to your kind." You inhale. But you get it now. Give Father Earth back his lost child, and perhaps his wrath will be appeased. That's the third faction, then. Those who want a truce. People and Father Earth agreeing to tolerate one another, even if it means creating the rift and killing millions in the process. Peaceful coexistence, by any means necessary. The end of the seasons. It sounds unimaginable. There have always been seasons. Except now you know that isn't true. "Then it isn't an option," you say finally. "End the seasons, or watch everything die as this season burns on forever? I'll..." Catch the moon sounds ridiculous. "I'll do what you stone eaters want, then."
"There are always options."
Her gaze, alien as it is, abruptly shifts in a subtle way. Or maybe you're just reading her better. Suddenly she looks human. And very, very bitter.
"And not all of my kind want the same thing."
You frown at her, but she says nothing more. You want to ask more questions, try harder to understand, but she was right. You weren't ready for this. Your head's spinning, and the words stuffed into it are starting to blur and jumble together. It's too much to deal with. Wants and needs. You swallow. "Can I stay here?" She does not respond. You suppose it wasn't really necessary to ask. You get up and move to the nearest cot. Its head is against the wall, which would put your head behind Alabaster and Antimony, and you don't feel like staring at the back of the Stone Eater's head. You grab the pillow and curl up with your head at the foot of the bed instead, so you can see Alabaster's face. Once you slept better when you could see him, across the expanse of Inan's shoulders. This is not the same reassurance. But it's something. After a while, Antimony begins to sing again. It's strangely relaxing. You sleep better than you have in months. "Seek the retrograde, obscured, in the southern sky. When it grows larger, obscured." Tablet 2, The Incomplete Truth, verse 6. 11. Shafa, lying down. Him again. I wish he hadn't done so much to you. You don't like being him to any degree. You will like less knowing that he is part of Nasun. But don't think about that right now. The man who still carries the name of Shafa, even though he hardly qualifies as the same person, dreams fragments of himself. Guardians don't dream easily. The object embedded deep within the left lobe of Shafa's sesapine interferes with the sleep-wake cycle. He does not often need sleep, and when he does, his body does not often enter the deeper sleep that enables dreaming. Ordinary people go mad if they are deprived of dreaming sleep. Guardians are immune to that sort of madness. Or perhaps they're just mad all the time. He knows it's a bad sign that he dreams more often these days, but it cannot be helped. He chose to pay the price. So he lies on a bed in a cabin and groans, twitching fitfully, while his mind flails through images. It's poor dreaming because his mind